Okay, so tonight I was going to talk about a fairly broad-ranging talk, which is an amalgamation of some talks I've done in the past outside the centre about why Buddhism's good, what it's doing in Australia, and where it might go, and how we can help it. I've never given a talk at the Buddhist Society before, but I've given a few shorter talks at some other societies at invites, so we'll see how this comes together. I guess the focus is on Buddhism in the West, because we're in Western Australia, and it's a new country, and Buddhism is new to a new country. We've only been here for 35-odd years as the Buddhist Society, and in my opinion, still developing an identity. And although this is subtle, it's an important thing to do and to try and get right if we want to have a very long-term future measured in centuries. So I guess as a background, my story for getting involved in Buddhism is probably similar to a lot of Westerners who weren't born into Buddhism. I was born in Perth, as Hugh said before, and I went to a Christian school run by Catholic monks, the Maris brothers, and only a few of them are in jail now for abusing children. Luckily, I wasn't one of them, but some of my classmates were. And at the time, I wasn't really enamored with religion, but I can see now that even though Christianity wasn't the religion for me, it did set up some good foundations, and it gave me a good template, I guess, to compare other things against, i.e. when I came across to Buddhism. So like a lot of people in their late 20s, early 30s, I began to achieve some material career success, I suppose, in my life, and then the big questions started coming. And that's what I see in the centre down here on a Friday night, is usually it's Westerners or young Westerners in their late 20s, early 30s saying, what can Buddhism offer me? And in my personal example, I came to Buddhism because I was achieving what I thought I wanted in my working career, but this came at the expense of quite a bit of stress, which I didn't know how to deal with. And so I was fishing around town looking for suitable meditation techniques, because I had a short introduction to it on a Stress in the Workplace program. And then I came to the Buddhist Society at the invite of a friend, and walked in here and went, this place feels really, really peaceful. And then I walked into the hall and went, this place is full of weirdos. There was monks in orange robes, and I guess I was used to monks from the Maris brothers, and a whole lot of people I probably wouldn't have necessarily come across before in my military and corporate background. But nevertheless, like a lot of Westerners, I soon realised, even on the first occasion, that the monks really knew what they were talking about when it came to meditation, and even just looking at them. I remember looking at Ajahn Brahm 10 years ago and thinking, this guy, he's fantastic, and he's walking the talk, because he's, to me at that time, he seemed so serene for a, whatever he was, 57-year-old or whatever he was at that stage, compared to a lot of 57-year-old managers I knew in the workplace. So I knew that there had to be some results in meditation. But I had a lot of trouble digesting the other stuff that came with it. And like a lot of people, I just stayed at the back of the hall, tried to pick up as much meditation as I could, and then as quickly as I could, chuff off out the door and try not deal with any actual Buddhists, because I was never going to become one, that's for sure. They're strange. I think for a lot of Westerners, that's a typical first experience. And what we see at the Buddhist Center is a lot of people come in for 4, 5, 6 sessions, and then it drops off, and it just becomes a little bit too hard to become more engaged. It's not in all cases, and mine as well, I guess. I became a little bit more engaged because as my meditation practice got a little bit better, I don't claim to be any great meditator, some of the teachings of Buddhism were more compelling than having to be uncomfortable up the back. So I kept on coming, and so I've been here for 10 years now, and I guess as president at the moment, my focus is on not trying to be a Dharma teacher or an upstanding Buddhist citizen or anything, but my focus is on how can the Buddhist society be more successful, and what was the Buddhist society set up for? And the Buddhist society was set up for transmitting the Dharma, exposing the Dharma to as many people in Western Australia as possible. That's literally the first or second point in the constitution, is to spread the Dharma. And secondary to that is all the other stuff. It says, after that, it says the constitution, we will support monks and we'll have a centre and this and that. But the number one thing is to spread the Dharma. And this is something that we shouldn't really forget. And I think that Buddhism actually does have a lot of compatibility in the West. So obviously, the West has been profoundly influenced by the Catholic Church. And I'm not here tonight to bag out the Catholic Church at all. But I'm going to use them as an example base, because they've been in the Western culture for more than 2,000 years. So they are on the decline. I saw in the latest statistics from the census that less than 5% of people are now going to church on a Sunday. And in the 1950s, it was over 50%. So whichever way you look at it, they're having a profound decline. And there's obviously a gap in society, because just like me when I got to my late 20s, eventually at least some of the population start saying, what's it all about? Where's it all going? And we've lost the Catholic Church, and what's going to take its place? And I really do think that Buddhism has a fantastic opportunity to sort of take up that mantle. And it'll never be as big as the Catholic Church was, and you'll never have 50% of Australians going to coming to the Buddhist Centre. We couldn't cope with the parking for a start. But there's a lot that Buddhism has to offer. And so if you're a Westerner coming to the Buddhist Centre for the first time, having that Christian basis and upbringing means that priests and monks is nothing foreign. And one of the things I think that gives Buddhism a lot of credibility with Westerners is the fact that there is a monastic order, and so there's almost sort of professional religious people whose job it is to keep the knowledge going generation through generation. And there's nothing more than Westerners love than organisation and structure around an activity. And Buddhism's got 2,500 years of having structure around meditation and the Dharma teachings. So already, you know, we're off to a pretty good start there. Buddhism is a compassion-based teaching, and the parallels with Christianity are obvious there from the New Testament and what Jesus was saying. So once again, if you're a Westerner and you're looking for something in your life, spiritual-based, Buddhism is not that foreign with those teachings. Probably Buddhism, and I found this a little bit difficult in my first encounters, has quite a strong emphasis on compassion, and that's a good thing. But coming in the first time from a rational, scientific Western world, it can be a little bit sort of overwhelming because in the Christian upbringing, it's not as heavily emphasised as it is in Buddhism. Another compatibility of Buddhism and the West is that Buddhism tends to stay out of politics, and this is a very good thing because it means that anyone can come, whether they're left wing, white ring, Nazi, communist, Greenpeace, doesn't matter. You can come down to Dharmaloka and learn meditation and the Dharma. And in the Western tradition, it's even in the constitution, it's a secular state, so there's a difference. The church and the government are not the same thing. And obviously in some other countries like the Middle East, this is the same. But this is another appeal for Westerners, and makes it fairly easy for Buddhism to gain profile. And then Buddhism starts to pull away from the parallels of Christianity when we come to the nitty-gritty teaching for lay people. So I divide the teachings of the Buddha into two categories, like he stated. That's the supramundane. So here we're talking higher meditative states and realms and stories of deities and I guess almost the cosmology of the universe. And then we've got the mundane. And the monks don't tend to focus on this so much because why would they? They're down in the monastery, the super athlete's village for Buddhists, trying to get enlightened. So they're not going to worry about the actual vast amount of teachings the Buddha's given on daily practical lay life. And obviously, I don't have to go without saying, the Buddha was a pretty clever sort of person. But by giving detailed teachings and suttas on daily life, the Buddhism made sure that there was plenty of hooks in it for the lay people. So I thought from another talk I did at the Perth Theosophical Society a couple of years ago, they wanted me to talk about what does Buddhism have to offer besides the stuff that some people who don't know much about it might think, like ghosts and all the rest of it. What does it actually have to offer? So if you do a bit of reading of the suttas, which I do, I decided to focus for this particular talk on the one thing that is almost the polar opposite of spirituality, and that's money. And the astounding thing is that the Buddha talked about money and told lay people how to make money and how to handle it and how to spend it. I couldn't think of any other spiritual teacher in the history of humanity who was telling people how to look after money. So I've got quite a few suttas here, but I'll just talk about three, in quick summary form. So if you've got a good memory, or you can ask me later. The first one I particularly like is from the Anaguttara Nikaya in the Pali Canon, Anaguttara Nikaya, chapter 4, number 61. This is a short sutta, and it's called The Four Things Most Commonly Wished For by a Layperson. Well, it's actually layman, but layperson, laywoman. If I drop back and start using the word man, it's because I'm reading off this, I'm not sexist. So the first thing that the Buddha said is that lay people wish to gain wealth. The second thing is that they wish to have respect and acclaim. The third thing is that they wish to have a long life. And then the fourth thing is that they wish to have a fortunate end. So I can't argue with any of that. That's exactly what I want. Maybe without the acclaim. But that's a pretty... He obviously had a very good understanding of the psychology of lay people to be talking like that. He then goes on in the sutta to say the four broad mechanisms for gaining wealth is the cultivation of wisdom, good behaviour, generosity in the community, and of course, faith in the Dharma. And he then goes on to talk about it in a little bit more detail, and he says if you want to make some money and get involved in business, there's three things you'll need to do. You'll need to have energetic striving, you'll have to use the strength of your own endeavour, and you have to engage in moral activity. He then goes on at the end of this sutta to say that if you do happen to obtain some wealth, and not many people do, there's four things that you should do to keep the cycle of wealth going. You should spend money on happiness for yourself and your family, and your women and your slaves, but we don't have those in the 21st century. That's a good thing, the slaves, that is. You should spend money on insurance. So unbelievably in this sutta, he didn't use the word insurance, there's another word for it, but the Buddha was basically saying you should insure against calamity, and he names them as fire, flood, theft, and taxation. You'd think he was here yesterday telling us. He says that if you become wealthy, you should engage in charitable donations and that you should support your local monastery. Then he goes on in another sutta. This is Anaguttara 4, number 62, which follows. And he talks about the four sources of happiness from wealth. So he's not saying the four sources of happiness are moral activity and meditation and enlightenment and this and that and the other. He's actually given a sutta on how money can make you happy. And he says that there's four things it does. It provides you with time for enjoyment and relaxation. It allows you to be debt-free. You can be happy with a guilt-free acquisition. So this ties back to engaging in moral activity in your work. And it allows you to give to a community in need. And then this giving will be a source of happiness. So he then goes on in, I'll just talk about two more suttas. The same book, the Anuguchi and Nikaya. So there's three main Pali books, and I'm just taking suttas from the Anuguchi and Nikaya. I haven't even checked out possible stories in the other ones. He probably wouldn't talk about money too much in the long suttas. But there could be more than 12 suttas on practical advice for dealing with money. And then he says the five dangers to wealth. And the astounding thing is this is 2,500 years ago and nothing's changed. The five dangers to wealth: fire, flood, thievery, government, or he calls it the king's taxation, and scheming children. So the Buddha said, when you're watching your money, be careful of your children. And the last sutta I'll just quickly cover before we get back on topic is the Anuguchi Nikaya 10, number 91, the behaviour of a preeminent wealthy man. So he lists in short form 10 things that the rich person would do. And the themes are always the same. You would seek wealth through righteous occupation. You would seek wealth without violence. You would use wealth for your own happiness. Use wealth for the happiness of others. Spend in moderation. Spend on good deeds. Not be infatuated with money. See the danger in excess and not be bounded to the wealth identity. So very, on one hand, very practical, pragmatic advice, but on the other hand, there is quite a bit of depth in there. And there's another sutta I remember where he talks about family budgets, and he actually talks, he says, it's something like 1/4 of your budget you should spend on food, 1/4 should be on housing maintenance and upkeep, 1/4 should be saved, and the other 1/4 should be spent for enjoyment. So he's even gone down, the Buddha, the world's biggest spiritual leader, is telling people how to plan a family budget. It's astounding. When I think about it, it's just astounding. And this really does mean that Buddhism has such a breadth of good daily advice that still works in the modern age, which of course people might not have heard before, that there's a lot on offer for the West, and we should be really trying our best to get the word out there. So then moving into the super mundane realm, as far as what Buddhism has to offer to the West, the first thing there's three things: karma, rebirth, and meditation. So meditation's an easy one. Meditation is stress reduction. If everyone's less stressed, then they're not breaking the law, or you're having easier relationships. It's obviously a no-brainer. And meditation is not actually something new to the West. So the 12th century Christian Gnostics, St. John of the Cross and these people, they were into meditation. And if you read their works, it would seem that they were jhana-achieving Christian monks. The language that they used all those centuries ago points to that. I don't see how it could be anything else. I'm not saying that they were enlightened or anything like that, but they were definitely achieving profound states of meditation. This didn't last very long. I think after about 100 years, the Catholic Church wiped them out because they might have been a threat to the 4th century onwards ideology of basically you live the one life and then you go to heaven. So meditation has a lot to offer to the West. Karma. So I don't think karma's incompatible with Western scientific thinking. In fact, I think that they complement each other, and in fact, really, science is just catching up. And in the Western Christian traditions, there's not really much talk about karma. It's all about what you do now, then gets judged once at the end, and that's infinity. But if you went down to Karrinup Shopping Centre tomorrow morning for Saturday morning shopping and you pulled up 100 people on a questionnaire and you said, "Oh, do you believe in karma?" I bet you 95 would say, Oh, yeah, I do. I think so. And it's just so common in conversation. Oh, so and so, you know, his wife's left him, or he's been involved in a bad deal, or this happened to him, or whatever. And then someone will say, oh, that's some bad karma there. But you know, he was misbehaving before. It just karma seems to be, I think, subconsciously linked into our minds, and from a Western point of view, it's simply just cause and effect, and that's the basis of science. So there's really no bones about karma in the West, as far as I can see. That then leaves the third compatibility, and that's rebirth. And from a Christian upbringing in the West, or an agnostic upbringing, rebirth is probably the biggest hurdle in Buddhism. And I have to, so I've got two science degrees, and I have to admit, when I first came to Dharmaloka, and then I was enjoying the meditation, and then I kept coming, when the monks would talk about rebirth and the Dharma talks, I'd just be thinking, these guys are crazy. Like, what are they talking about? These, you know, I want to take the meditation, but they can have the rebirth, and they can have all that other stuff. In my own personal experience, as I became more comfortable in meditation and began to really investigate Buddhism a bit more, suddenly rebirths did start to make a lot of sense. And then I had a few events in my personal life which helped me gain a bit more insight. And having had that experience, I would say to people coming for the first time, like me, don't worry about rebirth. Just put it to one side and stick at what you're doing if you enjoy it. And over time, you may begin to see some signs that this could possibly be the truth. And so I'm obviously a firm believer in rebirth. But rebirth isn't foreign to the West either. It's just been conditioned out of us for the last 1,500 years, for good reason, because you know, for 1,000 years of the Catholic Church's reign, if people were believing in rebirth, then that's the end of kingdom come and heaven with God and the punishment system. The whole thing begins to fall over. So it would seem to me that Jesus actually taught rebirth, and it is in the Bible. And I've got a passage to read you in a minute. But even before Jesus, the Greeks believed in rebirth. So this is the cradle of Western civilization. Socrates and these characters, they believed in rebirth. So it's not a foreign concept. It's just one that's sort of come and gone, and possibly it's coming back again. So so that any priests or Christian friends don't get up in arms because I've said this. In the Bible, in the King James Version, there's a passage about Jesus talking about rebirth. So the King James Bible was published in the 1600s by an English monarch called King James. And up till this point in England, the Bible was read in Latin. So everyone would go to church and not understand what was being said. King James decided to change that. The Latin Bible was a derivative of the Greek Bible, which was a derivative of the Hebrew Bible, which was the language of the Jews, which Jesus was. And so it had been through three translations over 1,000-odd years. And this obviously can lead to some pretty heavy editing. And particularly in the 4th century, when the Roman Emperor Augustus, he did a rewrite of the Latin Bible at the time, and quite a few things were dropped out of it. And this could be the point in history where references to rebirth were lightly treated in the editing, and were then could be reinterpreted as another message. However, the King James Version, this particular monarch, he sourced the Hebrew version from the Middle East and then got that translated directly into English. So we skip out the Greek and the Latin editing. So none other in the book of John. There's four famous books in the New Testament: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In John 3, verses 3 to 13, Here we have Jesus talking to a Jewish rabbi, a Pharisee, I think that's what a Pharisee is, in the temple. And I'll just have a drink of water and I'll read it. Jesus answered and said unto him, Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Nicodemus said unto him, How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter the second time into his mother's womb and be reborn? Jesus answered, Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. That which is born of flesh is flesh, and that which of born of spirit is spirit. Marvel not that I said unto thee, Ye must be born again. The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hast hear the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it come from, and whither it goeth. So it is every one that is born of the Spirit. Nicodemus answered him and said unto him, How can these things be? Jesus answered and said unto him, Art thou a master of Israel, and knowest not these things? Verily, verily, I say unto thee, We speak that we do know, we testify that we have seen, and yet we not receive our witness. If I have told you earthly things, and ye not believe it, how shall ye believe if I tell you of heavenly things? And no man hath ascended up to heaven, but that he came down from heaven, and even the Son of Man which is in heaven. That's the end. So that to me could not be interpreted in any other way except for Jesus talking about rebirth. I couldn't see it any other way. And we've talked about the translations and the rest of it, but I guess it just comes back to the point that even one of the most foreign aspects of the core teachings of Buddhism, which is rebirth, is not foreign to the Western world. And perhaps we're just coming back to it. So there's a list of eight things where there's quite a bit of compatibility with Buddhism and the spiritual vacuum, I guess, that we're finding ourselves in the last 50 years or so. Of course, for a balanced talk, there has to be talk of what might not be so familiar and what might be foreign. And this comes down to, I suppose, Buddhism in the West having to come from Asian countries, and Buddhism's gone to those Asian countries many centuries ago, and then it's built up some cultural accretions. And then when you transplant that again to Australia, a lot of it can seem quite foreign for the mainstream. And with the last census saying only 2.5% of people consider themselves Buddhist or practice Buddhism, then we have to say that we are not mainstream. And if one of our goals is to spread the Dharma and have more acceptance, the starting point is that we're not mainstream. And if we want to get there, if that's what the constitution of the Buddhist society is, if that's what the Buddha wanted to do when he set the wheel of Dharma rolling, what may be some impediments to that? I don't think there's any big impediments, and probably they're actually quite, cute in a way. The first one would be probably deity worship. I've most of my friends aren't Buddhists because that's the society I live in, and it probably doesn't help the Buddhist cause when people are lighting candles and incense and putting lotto tickets up on the Buddha statue and praying for a win on Saturday night and, talking about the rain, God's going to help them and this and that. That's a little bit hard for Westerners to reconcile. And I mean, the easy thing to do is just to put that to the side, because it seems a little bit like paganism, and definitely in places like Tibet and the like where Buddhism went across. And it even happened in the Catholic Church. Paganism never completely died out. But in this very scientific, rational society we find ourselves in, that's That's one little foreign part of Buddhism. And that even extends possibly to statue bowing. I remember when I first came here, it just blew me away. I saw all these people bowing to the statue, and I thought, my God, they're worshipping this golden statue. Does the Buddha still exist? What is he? What's going on? And the problem is that people come for sort of one or two or three visits. This place is not very social after the talks, and it's easy to get the wrong impression. And possibly people are bowing to the statue for different reasons. I managed to get over it by saying, okay, the reason I'm bowing is a genuine respect for the monks and the teachings of the Buddha, and to learn a bit of humility, and maybe that ties into personal development. Also the Pali chanting. The good thing is that the Buddhist texts are now all in English, and just like King James, that's the best way to engage the locals. I have to admit, and even today when I hear the Pali chanting, I don't know what's being said. I don't speak Pali. And there are English versions available, but definitely it certainly helps on a local basis if perhaps you're chanting in the local language. It makes it a little bit more inclusive. The English speakers are probably at a disadvantage when it comes to Pali chanting, because the languages are so far apart, and perhaps if you're from Sri Lanka or some of the Asian countries where there's a link to Sanskrit, you can understand what's going on. But certainly I don't. And really, none of those things are foreign impediments. And I guess what I'm hinting at here is that Buddhism, to be more successful in the West, people who are engaged in the temple at the local level really should be encouraged to allow it to adapt an Australian flavour, whatever that is. I mean, it's early days. But the worst thing that could happen is that, you know, if you're from another country and then you want sort of Buddhism to be exactly how it was back in this country, back in whatever time period you relate to, that's not really going to help the spreading of the Dharma. And what we want to do is allow Buddhism to gain an Australian flavour, so it becomes more accessible to the mainstream people. I guess the Buddhist Society has actually been, on the balance, very successful at bringing Buddhism to the West. One thing I see that's worked very well and probably held it together is Western monks ordaining young local men with connections to the community, and not sort of importing hordes of monks from wherever, Thailand or Cambodia or wherever, and expecting them to set up shop and the local people to have a connection. One thing the Buddhist Society has done a fantastic job of is integrating local monks. Our website as well, embracing the web and the technologies. So our website is now in the top 10 of Australian most visited websites. We had over 500,000 Dharma downloads last month, and our biggest audience is actually America, followed by the United Arab Emirates, a Muslim country. They're our number two audience. So we're actually doing a pretty good job, and to give the place a more Australian focus, whether it's this temple or other temples that may open. One thing that Buddhism doesn't do very well is socialising. And at this place here, we have a high turnover of people who come in, they pay their membership for 1 year or 2 years, they don't make any connections with other Buddhists. And the Buddha talked about Kalyanamitta, which is basically if you've got a good group of people around you who are acting correctly and into Buddhism, this is a reinforcing effect that allows you to travel, I guess, more efficiently along the Dharma path. And the Buddhist Society, which is the premier society in Australia, is doing a lot of things right, but the social aspect is definitely lacking. And as president, all the time I get mainly Western people come up to me and say, oh, you know, I can't make any friends, and I'm intimidated in the hall, and it's all just meditation, and that's about it. So I'm not going to stand here and criticize the society about that and not do anything. We're opening, we're attempting to build a new social club to help people feel more friendly and invited, and hopefully help the culture grow. So then, I guess finally, to bring this to a head. So if we acknowledge all this, and if we attempt to keep doing what we're doing, what is Buddhism going to bring to the West? What is it all about? And I would say that it's about a higher social conscious, and we've got the vacuum of the church, and you could say, well, a lot of people just went to church because they were forced to, because that was the social norm at the time. Nevertheless, they would have been hopefully learning and listening to some good Christian moral lessons, and that's gone. And we obviously find ourselves, and I'm in the thick of it as a layman in business, we find ourselves in a very material world. Almost every single day on the St. George's Terrace, where I roam and operate, it's about, when am I going to get the next Audi? How big's the next bonus going to be? And happiness is just tied into this material acquisition. There's no doubt that wealth is important, because you don't want to be living on the street. And obviously those suttas from the Buddha show that even the Buddha thought it was a good idea to have a little bit of money in the bank. But in the spiritual vacuum that's happened, the clever marketing men have taken over, and we just seem to be involved in this insane consumption of material resources, which not only doesn't have a tangible, lasting happiness effect on people, but it's bad for the environment. It wrecks the planet. We're using stuff that we don't need to use. We're digging stuff out, and I'm involved in this industry. We're digging stuff out of the ground to make more cars, to sell more stuff when we don't need to do it. And definitely Buddhism has a lot to offer in this circumstance. And in that instance, I mean, to sum it all up, it would be the middle way. If Buddhism just offers the middle way and just a little bit of moderation, that would be a fantastic thing for the West. Buddhism also offers a complete explanation of the cosmology. Again, if you go back into the suttas and do some reading, it's astounding at what's been recycled and what was known before, which we think we're discovering for the first time. So the Buddha talks about realms and devas, and science is sort of catching up now, and we're talking about investigating the nine dimensions. The Buddha talks about he had the eye over the 10,000 world system. So he's not talking about this world, he's talking about other worlds, and saying that in other worlds there's samsara and suffering, and we're just one of many. So there's no other way to say it, but he's talking about alien civilizations. What else could it be? How else can he be seeing 10,000 worlds and 10,000 civilizations without possibly looking across, say, the Milky Way? And now, you turn on the TV on any night to SBS or whatever, and they've got these amazing, marvelous shows about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and how it's sort of groundbreaking thinking. But 2,500 years ago in, not even medieval, in Bronze Age India, they acknowledged the fact that there were other worlds or planets capable of hosting life. And then I guess Buddhism, I guess, can offer social justice if that's what you want to call it. And this comes back to a higher social conscious. And the middle way, I suppose, is the only bridge that's going to occur at the moment in the politics of Australia. The middle way is the only thing that's going to bring people back together. So obviously in Australia, everyone's reading the papers. The last 10 to 15 years, we've descended into this identity politics where anyone can form a minority group and become the squeakiest wheel and get on their soapbox and complain about how they've been, whatever, downtrodden or mistreated or something's gone on, and put their hand out and ask for money from the government, and their cause is more righteous than anyone else's causes. And then, that's usually coming from the left. And then what happens? You cause and effect. You get the right wing firing up, and you get the neo-Nazis and the Australian Conservative Party and those sort of people firing up as well and sending shots back. And it doesn't really do anyone any good for politics to be this divided, because we lose unity. When you lose unity, every other group is basically the enemy, and you can sort of treat them in any bad way you want because they deserve it, because they're not part of my political group or movement at the time. And one thing I noticed about the Buddha was that in relation to politics, he was very clever, because he would, if you read the suttas, he would always just try and bring people together, but he would never actually go against the main issue of the day. And I've picked this up by trying to find somewhere in the suttas where the Buddha talks about slavery. So in that time in India, slavery was a big thing, as it has been actually for most of human history. And I can only find where the Buddha says that as far as livelihoods go, you shouldn't be a slave trader. But he never seems to make appeal to any of the kings or give sutta talks on how slavery should be banned and outlawed and this and that. He obviously decided quite wisely that he, as one preacher, wasn't going to change that social situation at the time. So he just presented a middle way. And if you read the suttas, he just says that as far as your slaves go, you should look after... Well, he puts them in the context of households, and he says you should look after your wives and your children and provide them with material comforts, and then you should... it sounds crazy. You should look after your slaves as well. And basically treat them as part of the household. So it just occurred to me that that's a very practical, outcomes-based philosophy. And he was going for the middle way. He wasn't saying, right, we're going to end this all tomorrow and free all the slaves and then start a new society. And of course he wasn't saying we should continue what we're doing. He was just looking for something in the middle. And I just think that middle way of social justice is a very practical way of doing things and getting at least some sort of decent result, understanding that you can't go all the way most of the time. And if Buddhism was to expand in Australia, and this way of thinking, this way being the middle way, the golden middle way of thinking, was to occur and slowly permeate throughout society, It could only be a good thing, because it's not a position, and it's not a philosophy and spirituality of extremes. And the problem with extremes is we can see what's happening in the Muslim world with the extremists in their religion, and that sort of thing obviously wouldn't be able to occur in Buddhism because of the middle way. So I think that this is the third thing over the long term on a broad scale that Buddhism can offer the West. And this is probably something that, those three broad, bigger picture strategic things is what inspires me to work with Buddhism and be on the committee and take the punishment as president. Maybe I'm just making up for bad karma in the past, but that's definitely something worthwhile striving for, would be to get the Dharma further out and just give people the opportunity just to have a taste of it. Make the Dharma and the Buddhist society more presentable, inviting and friendly, and get more people through the door. And all they need to do is just have a taste, just like one or two times and just a little bit, and just a bit of an affinity for Buddhism. And then over time and over generations, it can work. It's magic. So that was a fairly wide-ranging, broad, heavy talk maybe. And I'll leave you with that. And we've got about 14 minutes till 9 o'clock. So if there's any questions or discussions or feedback, I'll leave it to the floor. I think there's a microphone coming. Taz has got a microphone for Vicky, right?
Thank you.
Thank you, Drew. I really enjoyed your talk tonight, and I was at the Theosophical Society when you gave the other talk. I just like to share about, I'm also involved, I love coming here, I'm very involved in this Buddhism, but I'm also involved in the Nichiren, the Japanese, it's the lay Buddhism, And I'd just like to say how community-based and how wonderful everyone is socially towards one another. If someone's sick, then everybody visits that person. We pray, we chant for that person. On a Monday night, there's a chanting night, especially for any sick people, not necessarily Buddhists, just anyone. And the community really get together. If there's a new person, we go and welcome that person. We make them feel included. So it's a very, very engaging, community-based Buddhism. We meet in people's homes and share and help one another. We follow the Lotus Sutra, basically. That's the main teaching that we study. And, you know, it's... And the young people are very involved. It's wonderful to see these young people coming and helping the elderly. I'm very grateful that I'm involved.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it's one thing that's been definitely a little bit lacking at the Buddhist Society, and perhaps we'll never quite get to those lofty goals, but we can definitely make a few improvements.
I think just for people to actually be more open to one another. When we had the the Christmas, all the sharing outside, people, we all brought a plate and everything, it was so isolated that only people that knew one another talked to one another. And, you know, luckily I've got a few friends, but I was standing out there and nobody, I mean, you know, it was very, very unpleasant actually to you know, to just be eating and nobody talking to you. I mean, I'm very social, but it's very hard to be social with people if they are actually in their own little group and not open to one another.
Yep. Well, we'll see what we can do over time. Anyone? Don, the treasurer. Oh, here comes a microphone. I can't hear you, Don.
Ah, sorry. That was a good talk, Drew, and I'm glad I came to listen to you. Well researched. But just one or two small points. I think it was a bit cynical to say that Asian people come and offer incense there and hope for, did you say, lottery win or something like that? But actually there is a meaning to that, because in Asia, to offer incense is to sort of respect somebody. So it's a matter of respecting that people come and offer there. I think the vast majority will be respect. It's a matter of respecting the Buddha or whatever it is when they put the incense. The other point is, rather than saying that some of these cultural traditions are just something which should not be looked at by new Buddhists, better way to say is, see if there is a meaning in that cultural traditions. For example, like offering flowers, it's actually a meditation. I mean, you know, that's how we compare our bodies to the flowers fading away. So it's a meditation. So if you look, the new Buddhists also should be encouraged to look deeper into this cultural thing, which is called cultural things, but it has a deeper meaning.
Thanks, Don. So in regards to your first comment, obviously not all candle burning and incense is what I said. And in the Christian tradition, there's praying to the candle as well. I've travelled around Asia quite a bit, and I wasn't specifically talking about the Dana Hall. I was just talking about things I've seen. So clarification there. And the example you gave with the flowers, it's all about education, I suppose. I mean, if there is a meaning behind it, then perhaps the monks have to talk about it, or maybe it's in a booklet or something else, because, you know, most people come in, sit down, see it happen. They're too embarrassed to go and ask about it, because it could be some sensitive ceremony that's happening, and then that's how it can be propagated. But thanks for your points.
I was interested because you've got a bit of a background in economics, what your thoughts were on the compatibility of some Western economics with Buddhist philosophy. I mean, I'd say it'd be fairly obvious that certainly neoliberal economics would be pretty fundamentally opposed, I'd say, but are there any others that you see that are a bit more compatible?
So it'd just have to come back to the middle way and acting morally. So laissez-faire economics and Buddhism wouldn't work. So this is the economic model where there is no government intervention and the capitalists can just totally go for it. And we're seeing this occur in America now with the weakening of government's regulatory authority since the early 1980s. The disparity of between rich and poor is massive in America. I can't remember. It's something like 92% of the wealth of America is concentrated in 12 or 13% of the population, and this has been growing over time. And this is exactly what happens when you do have laissez-faire or completely free market economics. And I'm a believer in basically fairly strong government regulation, because I'm an entrepreneur in the business world, and I deal with people who are very, very astute and very good at business, and they have a massively unfair advantage, and over time we'll just end up like America. And so we do need government regulation to even the playing field, because generally they will act immorally, because the dollar is the bottom line. And the problem with economics is it doesn't concern itself with externalities. So economics, the equations are only concerned with input equals output equals price equals volume, basically, and they don't concern themselves with the cost to the environment. You know, okay, so we set up this factory and we make all this stuff and we can make $1 million a year, but how much sulfur did we put into the environment? What's the cost of the sulfur? How many, you know, you could even say how many plants per hectare get killed by the sulfur that comes from the factory? That's a cost that should be put back into the equation, or you know, you should be saying, right, and then there's an environmental tax or whatever else. And yeah, so in Buddhism is the middle way, and the middle way is not communism. That doesn't work either, because that just ends up at the communist economic model, the extreme. That just ends up with the political power elite controlling all the money and then all the people. And the laissez-faire American model, that doesn't work either. So we should be in the middle with a reasonable amount of freedom for business people to do what they have to do to make a dollar and create jobs, but also probably, I don't know if you could put a percentage on it, but for instance, in regards to the banking sector, I would say another 30 to 40% regulation would be needed in Australia alone. Just look at the Commonwealth Bank and their money laundering for terrorists. There's obviously not enough. So we do need a little bit more, and I would say that communism and laissez-faire are not economic models for Buddhism, and it's somewhere in the middle, maybe not so far from where Australia is at the moment. Yes, sir. I don't know if there's a microphone.
Thank you. I haven't been a deep student of Buddhism like yourself and people like Virginia and many, many others here. But one of the things that appeals to me in a basic way about Buddhism, which might seem a strange thing to say, is I totally and utterly have believed all my life and still believe greatly in the scientific explanation of evolution. And my understanding, reading the internet, is Buddhism, I just wonder whether you agree or not, totally accepts the scientific explanation of evolution, as opposed to the Christian viewpoint of creation. I just wondered what you've got to say about that.
I would say in regards to Christianity that so Christianity's got the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Old Testament is basically the Jewish word, I suppose, and they believe in the creation of the world. The New Testament is quiet, I think, on well, there's nothing about creation in the New Testament. So I think for for Christians, they can actually, if they want, believe in evolution, because there's nothing in their book, in that second half of the New Testament, that disputes it. As far as Buddhism goes, there's no conflict on evolution, because the Buddha is silent on evolution. And
that's what I understood. Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing. He just talks about the natural progression. In fact, he is pro-evolution, because he talks about the expansion and contraction of the universes over eons. So the Buddha's talking about big bangs and big crunches. And once you talk about that, then you have to believe in evolution, because if it starts somewhere and then life builds up and then life declines, there's an evolution. So actually, the Buddha's gone one step further. He's talking about evolution and then de-evolution. So we're not going to live long enough and have memories for the next lives, I suppose, but I would assume at some point we'll then see a de-evolution. And we see this through civilizations, you know, the rise and fall of Rome, the rise and fall of the fertile belt in the Middle East. Why wouldn't this also apply to species?
Thank you. Just quickly adding to that, I've got a cousin who's been trained as a minister in the Anglican faith and so on, and he's trying to rejoin a church that he was a member for many years, and he's been denied admittance so far because he believes in evolution. But on the other hand, what I have read in a number of cases, and he says the same thing, 40% of Christians now believe in evolution. And the Pope, for example, in 2014 accepted the Big Bang theory and so on. So there's a big division going on there. But
yeah. Yeah, well, it's a broad church, and I'm definitely not here tonight to bag out the church. I'm just very familiar with it because it's where I came from as a child. And like any institution and organisation, they're having their ups and downs and their believers and disbelievers. And, you know, most people that go there have got good hearts and are doing the right thing, and that's where it ends. So was there any other questions? We've got about 2 minutes before we...
Just a quick statement. Just out of interest, a friend came back from China, and apparently the Catholic Church is just expanding enormously. It's the biggest thing, apparently. It's just in Africa, it's just expanding enormously, apparently, the Catholic Church, which surprised me, because I didn't think that was, you know, that was permissible with communism, but apparently it's just, it's incredible.
New recruits. Well, they're losing people here in the West, so they pick them up in China and Africa. save those souls. We should be over there as well. Anyway, I think I'll just wrap it up there, and I'm just going to bow 3 times to the Buddha. I'm not going to attempt any chanting, and we'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Drew.